Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's podcast, I'm joined by Lauren Duncan, who has just finished her PhD looking at the intersexuality between race, relationships and anorexia. Lauren wrote a blog for us on this topic, and I was so inspired by the blog I wanted to discuss it further. We talk about all the different themes that came up from the conversation she had with participants, and it was so interesting to explore this further with her.
On with the podcast. What? That's from a podcast, isn't it? On with the podcast.
I've heard of that. What, isn't it yet? No, it's not. I don't know.
Me. Somebody goes on with the show or something. Is it off menu? I don't know. Anyway, my brain is clearly in a different planet this afternoon. Oh dear. Okay. It's absolutely lovely to have you join me finally. I'm so incredibly sorry that I have cancelled so many times.
Not at all.
But yeah, so obviously you wrote a blog for us and it was an incredible blog. And the fact that you're doing research on this topic as well, I really, really wanted to speak to you about it. So for the listeners, would you like to just introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name's Lauren, and I have just finished my doctoral research. So it was 3 years, like the longest 3 years of my life.
You finished?
I finished. Well, I've just done my Viva, so I've now I've just submitted my minor amendment. So finally, like it's gone. I don't want to think about it forever.
Does that mean you're officially Dr. Lauren Duncan?
Do you know what, Han? I think in my head, I've been calling myself Doctor. I don't care what anyone says. But I think officially I have to wait until like the amendments have been approved and things like that. So, but yeah.
Well, can we put on the podcast episode Dr. Lauren Duncan?
Can we, please?
Yeah, we can. Whose permission are we asking for?
I don't know.
Yeah, no, we will absolutely do that. Oh, that is so exciting. I've had quite a few friends actually just finish their PhD projects and do their
Vivas
and like get their bound thesis and stuff like that. And it is so nice to see all that hard work over the past few years pay off, because, you know, you actually sell your soul to a PhD. Like, I considered doing a PhD and, no offence, glad I didn't.
No, I think, you know what, I think if I'd known... No, that's not fair to say. I am glad I did it, but I think if someone had warned me of how much work was involved beforehand, I'd probably think about making this, like, think about it a lot more before deciding upon it. And you know what? I've been such a like dragon to like everyone around me during this PhD. I've been such bad company. So I feel like I feel very grateful for people that have kind of supported me with it. I definitely wouldn't have been able to do it on my own. For sure.
But also I think if somebody had warned you or told you about, like, you know, oh, it's so hard and there's so much work and stuff, maybe you wouldn't have done it. And so going in thinking, oh, this is going to be bliss. I don't know whether that was what you thought, but maybe that's a better approach, because then you do it.
Yeah, no, you are so right, actually, because in some ways I think I can... Once someone has told me something and it's like, you know, it's going to be really hard, I will then catastrophize and be like, it's going to be the worst thing. I can't do it. So actually, it's probably a good thing. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so for the listeners, obviously, I know what your PhD, what the top general topic was. But what did you do your PhD on?
So my research is looking at the experiences of romantic relationships in Black women who have had anorexia. And so it's qualitative research, and it involved interviewing 9 Black women who have had some experience of anorexia and who are willing to talk about their experiences of romantic relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's amazing. I think, you know, from the blog that I read that you did, it feels like just a topic that people really haven't sort of written about. And, you know, I think the different elements of it, like, you know, race and eating disorders, race and relationships, relationships and eating disorders, like each element, I think, like added together. So then to bring that all together in one was really vital.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think because when I was doing my like research, my like literature review beforehand, what was really clear to me is that there hadn't been research that looked at the intersectionality between race, romantic relationships and anorexia. And there was a real dearth of knowledge and research in this area. And I just thought there's a clear gap, you know, there's a clear need. And a lot of the research out there on both eating disorders and anorexia, it's been sort of overwhelmingly quantitative and just focused on the physical manifestations of the illness and kind of just very reductionist ways of looking at people's experiences of quite profound significant areas of their lives.
That's really interesting, because when you were saying that, then I was like, I know what she's going to say. I didn't expect you to say that it was like majoritively quantitative. Like, what I expected you to say was the majority of the research has been done in white women. And so I think the fact that, you know, that's interesting in itself, that it's been majorly quantitative rather than qualitative for something that's so, I guess, emotive and has such an impact on your mental health and the way that you feel, it seems ridiculous that, you know, most of the research is focused on the physical aspects of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it highlights and it mirrors a lot of people's experiences where they seek help. I think individuals with eating disorders, there is a lot of the focus on the physical, which of course is important, but often it's at the expense of the emotional, the psychological. But no, you're absolutely right in your immediate thinking that the research has been focused on white women, because that was absolutely true. You know, there was the research itself is overwhelmingly Eurocentric, and there was very little research out there on minority ethnic groups, and specifically a real lack of research on Black women specifically.
I guess I'm wondering where we kind of start with your research, but would it be kind of sensible to think about maybe the like overarching themes that you kind of looked at in your research, and then we can kind of go through and discuss them and dive deeper into those areas?
Yeah, so having done my analysis, there were kind of five main themes that I think emerged, and those what really was clear is that low self-esteem and chronically low self-esteem was a shared experience of participants, where they kind of really questioned their positioning in the world. And there was a sense that the confluence between the participants' eating disorder and their race seemed to create this nebulous sense of space where they questioned their positioning in the world, both physically and sort of like more figuratively. So like physically, they felt like they were taking up too much space, but also, I guess, more figuratively and metaphorically, they kind of questioned their identity in the world, whether there was a sense of belonging. And that was really interesting. And then there was another theme just which looked at the kind of the ambivalence that a lot of the participants described about being in a romantic relationship. And that same ambivalence was described, kind of that same ambivalence is mirrored in their relationship to their eating disorder itself. So a lot of the women kind of had these mixed feelings about romantic relationships, but also about their eating disorder, in that they kind of, there was a part of them that felt that they needed the eating disorder to some extent. And I guess it speaks to the egosyntonic nature of anorexia. It's like, you know, there is this push-pull dynamic. And interestingly, on that, the anorexia for many of the women was kind of portrayed as like a third partner in the relationship. So almost like this kind of like, you know, it's kind of like a trade-off or a battle between a romantic relationship, the romantic partner, and the anorexia. And then we've got the theme of like difficulties negotiating and navigating boundaries in a relationship that a lot of the women described. And a very common theme, then the fourth theme, was a complex relationship to sex and the body. that the participants described. And then the fifth and the final theme looked at the hopes and dreams for the future. And kind of, it was more, it took a, I want to say optimistic stance, but many of the participants also described kind of their feelings of lament because of their experiences of their eating disorder and their difficulties that they've experienced in their romantic relationships in the context of their race and their culture.
Sorry, I've never heard of that word before. What does that mean, lament?
Lament. So it's like, I guess in this context, it's kind of they, what they say over and over again, it's kind of they're expressing their distress of something. So they emphasize it.
Got you. Okay.
Yeah.
That's, wow. Okay. Yeah. I think that's so interesting because there's such like a broad range of themes that you found there. And it would be really interesting to kind of talk to you about how kind of the intersectionality of all three elements there. So I guess if we start with the low self-esteem.
Yeah.
I guess, how did that interplay? Was it that the individuals had sort of low self-esteem because of their race and feeling like they fit in, and then the eating disorder came along? Or was it the eating disorder sort of also gave them self-esteem and then they like looked to relationships to fill that void?
Yeah.
Like, it's really interesting to think about how they interplay.
It's such a great question, Han, because I think because there are so many different components, it's very hard to isolate them and say, this, you know, they had low self-esteem and it started in this area. I think what really emerged is that it is the intersection of all three components. So I think a lot of the participants, there was a low self-esteem, and that, you know, just as anyone can experience low self-esteem, it's often due to a combination of factors, life experiences, perhaps there being a propensity to feel lower about oneself. But what really was clear actually is that participants' ethnicity and the way systemic factors related to their race and ethnicity contributed to this lack of sense of belonging. And that seemed to be a very kind of underlying factor behind a lot of the participants' low self-esteem. And that's not to say, I think what's really important is that it's not their race that causes the low self-esteem. It's the systemic factors and the way that they are treated and the way that society treats them that kind of contributes to that low self-esteem. And then because of that sense of lack of belonging, there's a kind of craving or a need, a desire to be accepted and to be loved. And some of the participants described, you know, really yearning for that in a romantic partner, but never quite being fulfilled. Some did, but there was a sense that constantly yearning to fill that void, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that's so common, isn't it? When individuals, you know, and I'm not just talking about in the context of eating disorders here, individuals struggle with low self-esteem, they look externally for that validation and really try and get, you know, that love and that affection from other people. And it goes back, you know, I remember like when I was 18 or whatever and I was trying to find a boyfriend and my parents would be like, you know, if you can't love yourself then no one can love you.
Yeah.
But it's so true, isn't it? Like, I think you can keep pining and you can keep looking for that intimate relationship, but unless you actually have that relationship with yourself and that's strong, you can't really get that from other people, because one, you're not able to kind of give them also what they need from the relationship. But I think if you don't have that connection to yourself, how can you form it with anyone else?
I love that. Yeah, it's so true. And it's a sense that, you know, I think if you're, as you say, I think if you're constantly striving to be loved by others, there's a sense that, you know, it's, everything is very conditional. You have to meet other people's expectations in order to be loved, rather than it being an inherent sense of I'm good enough. And I think that's what came across in quite a few of the participants' accounts, this kind of sense of needing to prove that they're good enough, needing the validation that they're good enough, and not, you know, perhaps not believing it themselves.
And did you find, I mean, this is me making an assumption here, but that the eating disorder came in sort of as a way there to prove that they were good enough, you know, particularly with like the Western ideals and thin body ideals and things like that. Was that an element that came into play in terms of, you know, if I look a certain way, I'll then be accepted?
Yeah, I think to some extent, I think what's quite difficult is it's a reciprocal relationship between the two. So the low self-esteem for many, I think, you know, as they kind of expressed, did contribute to the development of their eating disorder, their anorexia, but also the anorexia then, there was a feedback loop, but the anorexia then, you know, led to a reduction in their self-esteem in many cases. So I think for many of the participants, they did kind of they did develop their eating disorder, their anorexia, as a way to fill that void. And, you know, that's when I kind of was speaking about, which I guess I'll come on to when if and when we talk about the other theme. But they kind of almost, for some, they portrayed their anorexia as like a kind of a person. They kind of personified it in many ways. Yeah. It became this very real thing. And that perhaps speaks to the fact that they really craved someone to be there for them. But I guess what I would highlight as well is that I think, because you mentioned kind of the westernized view and assumptions about eating disorders and anorexia, I think what I found or what I gathered from hearing several of the participants' accounts is that for the Black women, it kind of seemed to be, the anorexia seemed to be less about the physical body in some situations, less about the physical body and physical starvation, and more about a kind of starvation and a hunger in the mind and this need for like a genuine connection. And that's not to say that it wasn't to do with the body for many of the participants, but there was a sense that it was kind of more than that, which I think for many people who struggle with eating disorders, it is more than that. But I think that's what was particularly striking to me when hearing my participants' accounts.
Yeah, I think that's a common misconception, isn't it? That, you know, someone has an eating disorder just because they want to be thin or because they want to change their body. But I'm interested in there what you said about, like, you know, that sort of mental starvation and then providing connection. Like, how did people describe that in terms of that link of the mental starvation to then forming a connection?
It is quite a paradox, isn't it? Because in some ways, what I'm saying and what the participants were describing is this sense of loneliness and not being understood, but by starving themselves emotionally, that was their way of coping. But in some ways that kind of starves them even more of connection. So it's a bit of a paradox, and actually I've not thought about what their understanding of that is and what their reasoning is for doing that, if they could make sense of that. But it's really good, actually. It's really interesting that you've asked that.
I think it's super interesting. And the reason I asked the question was because I can totally relate to that. And I think from my personal experience of having anorexia, it was, you're so, well, it's kind of funny. I was so lonely and had such low self-esteem that I thought the only way for me to be loved is for me to look a certain way. So for me, I think it did genuinely start as like a, if I look a certain way, then people will accept me more, and, you know, I'll be more confident, or I'll be more accepted, or people will like me more, people will admire me, people will look up to me. And it is completely a paradox. And I was actually thinking about this earlier, because, you know, as we mentioned at the start of the podcast, like, I just keep going, I never stop, like, I don't let myself be ill, I don't let myself rest, and I do that because I want people to think that I'm strong. I want people to think that I can keep going, that I'm Wonder Woman. But actually within that, what you then do is you don't appear weak, obviously, but I'm now ill more, or, you know, I can't do everything I want to do. And therefore people's, you know, I'm assuming that people will think of me, God, she's always ill. And it's the same with anorexia. I distinctly remember saying to my therapist, the reason I do this is I want people to know that I can deal with anything. Like, I can push myself to limits that other people can't do. I can restrict my food intake further than other people can. You know, I can exercise on very little because that's what makes me strong. And I remember saying it out loud, and her saying to me, but do you actually think people think, do you actually think that people then think that you're strong? Because what actually then the reality was is people were feeling sorry for me because I had an eating disorder. People were feeling, you know, oh, you know, we're so worried about Hannah and all of that. And that was a massive tangent, but basically the point that I was trying to make is it's very similar with relationships, is that I engaged in the eating disorder because I thought that my partner would love me more if I looked a certain way. I thought that, you know, he would admire me on this, that and the other. But what it actually did was it completely drove us apart. You know, I had no energy for connection, for communication. I lost a lot of friends because, you know, they were kind of, rightly, wrongly, they were sick and tired of the fact that I kept cancelling on them or I couldn't be there for them, things like that. You know, I completely lost my libido, all of this. So I can completely understand what you're saying about that paradoxical nature of it, in that you go into it with the intention of this is going to kind of make me a better person and I'll come out better. But actually what the eating disorder does is zaps you of everything. And then the only relationship you have left is your eating disorder.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think you just kind of, you captured and described just the kind of the paradoxical aspects and elements of anorexia so well, in that it kind of, there's this constant conflict and it's constantly kind of your first aim or your first goal is kind of completely turned on its head by the end. And it's really kind of this paradox in terms of kind of you, it's almost like you want to prove that you're worth being loved, but you're shrinking so much small. Your life and your physically yourself, you're shrinking so small. But it's like that in itself clamours for recognition. So there is this sense that you're becoming smaller, but by coming smaller, you want people to notice. And it really adds to the confusion, the complexity. And I think, you know, often what's really spoken about is the difficulty to understand the illness. And I think that speaks to very much the frustration that sufferers feel. You know, they're not quite understanding, there's constant conflict. And then in the end, as you say, the only thing that they often, the only thing that people can trust is their anorexia or their eating disorder. And of course everyone's experience is different, so I'm mindful that, you know, this might not be everybody's experience, but often from the experiences that I've heard and the accounts that I've heard, there does seem to be a theme there, completely what you were saying, just of this conflict, this inner conflict, these contradicting demands and motivations.
And it's crazy how, you know, I remember initially when I first said it out loud, in terms of like, I see my eating disorder as a separate entity, as another person. And then I remember my partner saying, you know, it feels like there's three people in this relationship. And that to me was really bizarre, that not only was it me feeling like, you know, there was this other person that sort of I could depend on and all of that, but he also felt like in our relationship there was somebody else. And another question I wanted to ask you was, I think you mentioned this in the blog, was talking about the experiences of Black women and having anorexia and actually the anorexia making them quite vulnerable, and then like almost leaning into relationships in that sense because of that vulnerability. And kind of, you know, getting a negative response from that in terms of abuse or kind of, you know, emotional and physical abuse.
Yeah, I think there's many elements to that. I think because a lot of the research says that those with anorexia and other eating disorders, they do tend to, as I said, have low self-esteem, and often they subordinate their own needs and prioritize other people's needs. And that can often predispose them to sometimes being victims of, you know, abuse in whatever form that may be, because they have that tendency to subjugate their own needs. And I think the element of being Black and in society often being, you know, being victims of racism, of discrimination, that is another component to it, where they kind of fall into this role sometimes of not being respected, and there is a real sense of vulnerability. So not only is there a vulnerability because of the anorexia, but also because of this kind of underlying low self-esteem, the element of race, ethnicity and culture. And it kind of creates the perfect storm, if you like, for negative dynamics in a relationship.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you more about sort of the impact of race, and you mentioned ethnicity and culture there. Were there any common themes for people, or did they have any understanding as to the impact that, obviously, like you said at the start, it's not the impact that the race is having on them, it's the impact that maybe, you know, society's views of their race or society's views of their culture that then leads them to develop an eating disorder. Did anyone have any ideas around that?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that came out from hearing some of the participants' accounts is the fact that, you know, there's often a stereotype that Black women are voluptuous and perhaps more curvy than white women or those from other ethnic groups. And interestingly, it was almost as if some of the women were fighting against that stereotype and wanting to kind of show that that wasn't always the case. And it was kind of almost an implicit way of fighting back. And there is an aspect of that kind of showed up in a lot of the cases. But what I'm going on a tangent here, but what came out of that, from some of the interpretations, is the fact that gendered racism plays a real part in a lot of the experiences. So what some of the Black women described is that, you know, there is this stereotype that Black women can be loud, big, and feisty and take up space. And actually they wanted to fight against that by becoming physically smaller and being less dominant in a relationship. And a couple of the participants actually said, you know, they wanted to be physically smaller. They wanted to be dominated, to kind of, you know, as a way of, in some ways, undermining that stereotype. And I think it's kind of this sapphire, it's called the sapphire stereotype, I think, that Black women can be seen as loud and big and aggressive, and that's not, and they wanting to show that that's not always the case, and kind of wanting to really prove and go against that.
Yeah, and how sad that there's such a stigma or such a stereotype that people feel they need to inflict that much pain on themselves to prove that that's not always the case. You know, like, you should just be able to kind of be the person that you want to be.
Absolutely, it's incredibly sad. And so, you know, it's, there's a sense that they felt so powerless in some ways. There's a real sense of powerlessness because of the stereotypes that are forced upon them in society, that they felt that they had to actually, you know, harm themselves in some ways. So there was that component to it. And then there was, I guess, there was another strand to it that was expressed by some of the other participants, in that what it means to starve yourself, and there was kind of connotations of it means that I'm disciplined, and from that came the connotations of like religion, and like several of the participants described being religious, and particularly Christian, and you know, one of the kind of like a Christian ideal for many is kind of I guess sexual purity, but also sometimes fasting and showing, you know, and having discipline in those areas. And so there was a real kind of a linking to the need to restrict their food and the need to restrict their sexual activity, and in some ways to be pure in many ways, and kind of be so pure that in some ways you were kind of, they were kind of becoming a child again physically, but also in terms of their relationships.
Yeah, gosh, that's so interesting, because like you just described so many elements there of kind of trying to appear childlike in the way of, you know, making yourself smaller, but then also not engaging in sexual activity. And I guess that's really interesting that you brought up the sort of notion of religion. Was there any kind of strong themes there for people in terms of the role that that had to play in terms of relationships, because I feel like a lot of people do describe that they have, you know, like a relationship with their religion. Did the eating disorder kind of get in the way? I know there's so many different elements. I'm like, oh my God, where do we even go with this? So,
yes, yeah. I think it was a really kind of complex area, and it was quite specific for each participant mm-hmm. who did bring religion in it, because I imagine it's kind of a very personal experience.
Yeah.
But what kind of came across my sense is that the religion and the kind of the ideal sometimes it didn't necessarily kind of perpetuate the eating disorder, but it meant that to the outside, to people looking in, so for instance people's partners, it was almost encouraged, like, oh, it's this is really great, you know, this is very very disciplined, and it wasn't questioned so much because mm-hmm. In some ways it was seen culturally as important and something to strive towards. You know, that's really great. You're being pure. You're able to sacrifice yourself in many ways. So I guess there's a sense that perhaps there was less of a questioning of mm-hmm. some of their restrictive behaviors until much later on.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think, a common theme across eating disorders, isn't it? In that so many of the behaviors are almost normalized, or they're seen, you know, they're praised by society, particularly I think with anorexia. You know, you've got kind of like I'm sure there's even more than two elements, but, you know, getting that praise from society of being in a smaller body, but then also getting that praise from your partner for following your religion. And then I'm sure that there would be people in the religious group saying, wow, you're doing so amazing at all of this, and look how pure you are.
Yeah, absolutely, Hannah. And I think there's kind of two components to this, or two strands to it. So there's that, where people are being kind of positively reinforced in many ways, but then there is also another theme that came out for some of the participants is kind of the other side, where actually they weren't getting necessarily the positive reinforcement, but and that in itself was a driving factor for them, because they didn't want the connection. So for instance, they didn't feel connected to their culture, and their culture so there is a stereotype, rightly or wrongly, that some Black communities enjoy food and, you know, the social elements of food, the community aspects of food. So denying oneself of food disconnects them from their culture. So there was a sense of wanting that to happen because they didn't want to be part of their culture. And so in some ways it was very complex, in that some of the participants did describe being positively reinforced by the people around them, and others there was a sense that they liked the negative comments being made by people around them, because it was a way for them to disconnect, which is what they wanted to do, perhaps as a way of protecting themselves, as a way of distancing from their culture, if that's what they felt that they wanted to do but couldn't do in other ways. But it's so complex and so rich, such rich accounts, and I feel, you know, I'm probably not doing it any justice at all, and kind of talking about it very simplistically, especially because I'm very aware of the fact that even within one individual there are multiple often conflicting motivations and forces and factors that are going on for them.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think the fact that, you know, even if we are simplifying it so that it's kind of, you know, we can talk about it on a broader scale, the fact that you did the research on it and, you know, put your time and your 3 years into it is amazing. So don't kind of put yourself down for that. But I think, you know, it is so complex. But I think that shows us, not just with eating disorders in Black women, but eating disorders across the board, like everyone's experience is so unique, and there's so many things that interplay and kind of work together or against each other that can make it so conflicting, which is why eating disorders are so incredibly complex, because also you can suggest, you know, this is something that maybe impacted me. We don't know for sure. Like, it could have, I always think that it could have been literally like something tiny that happened when you were 2 years old. How the hell are you going to ever know that?
Yeah, exactly. So Exactly. And it's often a combination of so many different factors. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's really important when services, you know, when formulating a client's difficulties and mm-hmm. to really understand from their perspective, you know, the different elements in their lives, incorporating, you know, their social experiences, their, you know, the environment, genetics, so many different factors, and really hearing from the individuals themselves, because mm-hmm. there are so many factors involved, as you say, and there's not one factor to blame, if that makes sense. Because yeah. I think what's also really important to highlight is that particularly with anorexia and other eating disorders, there is often this kind of this blaming aspect to it, like mm-hmm. Who was it in my life that contributed to it. And often I kind of what's time and time again what is coming across is that it's just a combination of so many complex and nuanced factors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is a great time to just slip in here as well, and this is something I've been really passionate about talking about, is just because somebody has an element of them that could potentially cause an eating disorder doesn't mean that was the cause of their eating disorder. Like, often we hear like, oh, you know, somebody is neurodiverse or somebody is transgender or what have you, and that must have been the cause. And it's the same here, you know, somebody is a Black woman, therefore that must have been the cause. No, that could be completely unrelated to why they developed an eating disorder, but it's an important factor to, when you're formulating their treatment, to actually incorporate and think about the impact that that may have had and the impact that that may have going forwards as well.
Yeah, that's such a good point, because I think there can sometimes, you know, whilst we need to kind of consider all of these factors, there can sometimes be the risk of assuming, ah, that's what happened, you know, there was this traumatic experience yeah. that you had, this is what it was, or, you know, ah, you not felt accepted by your peers because of perhaps your ethnicity or your race, and then it pinning it on that, when actually that might not be the individual's experience, and then you're reenacting the fact that they're not feeling yeah. understood, and the whole cycle is just reinforced, you know. So I yeah. think that's a really, really great point. I'm really glad you mentioned that.
You're literally saying, oh, you have this thing about you, therefore, and that could have been a cause of your eating disorder. So it's now making out that that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
So yes. That's something I'm very passionate about talking about at the moment. But I guess moving on to the other themes that you mentioned boundaries.
Mm.
And my head has completely forgotten why you even... I mean, not why you even mentioned it, but I can't remember.
yeah,
I can't
yeah.
remember the sort of relation that it had. So do you mind yeah. talking a bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. So there was this kind of sense that in participants that had relationships, there was a difficulty with communicating their own needs and articulating their own needs in relationships. So as I think I touched on, they were kind of like prioritising their partner's needs and would actually find it very hard to identify what they wanted. So actually, interestingly, in some of the interviews when I'd ask them questions about themselves and their own experiences, a lot of the focus was on, oh, well, my partner wanted this and I think I wanted that too. And it was a sense that almost they couldn't separate their own needs from those of their partners, because, you know, for many they had prioritized other people's needs for so long that they'd lost sight of their own, or perhaps they didn't feel able to communicate, or there was a guilt in identifying what they wanted in their relationships. And there was also this sense that for many of the participants, perhaps linked to their low self-esteem, they were almost very grateful, overly grateful for the fact that their partner was there at all, or the mm-hmm. fact that, you know, they were showing them any kind of attention. So they almost felt indebted to them. So in terms of what comes to my mind as the theme is that in terms of their kind of sexual encounters, they would often feel that they had to meet the needs of their partner, weren't always able to express what they wanted because they wanted to thank them, you know, for thank you mm-hmm. for being there for me, thank you for giving me a chance. And so there's a sense of just not being able to respect one's own boundaries sometimes, and being able to say no, actually that's not what I want, and not being able to communicate that. So it's that was a very strong theme, and it was an underlying thread for all participants. But I say all participants, I think the majority of participants. But what I would say is that whilst that was the experience of the majority of participants, some one or two of the women actually described how they kind of went the other way, where they, in their relationships, because they knew that they were vulnerable to being exploited, they actually focused only on their own needs and didn't consider those of their partners. So it was very much like, no, I'm doing this and I am only eating this and I'm going out here and you can come with me or you don't come with me. And there was a sense that, you know, almost overly clear boundaries in that no, you know, and it was a sense that saying no to food and using the anorexia was such a clear boundary that it gave them reassurance in their relationships and a sense of safety for them, whether that be a full safe sense of safety or not. But it was a way for them to put boundaries in place in many ways.
Yeah. It almost, and please tell me if I'm making the wrong assumption here, but it almost sounds as though almost the eating disorder acted as a sort of sense of identity in the way that it allowed people to do certain things or to act in a certain way and that be okay or not be okay, but and that kind of be how they were because of their eating disorder. And I think, you know, you in terms of the relationship piece, it's almost having such that I think it ties in the first theme, having such low self-esteem that you are then particularly vulnerable, which then means that you kind of are vulnerable to other people as well. And not necessarily in a horrible way, but putting other people's values and what they need before yourself is almost a form of self-harm, like an eating disorder is anyway, because it's, you're not engaging in self-care there by putting other people first. And it's really like minimizing you and what you need in order to put somebody else first, if I'm making sense.
No, absolutely. And I think that's a really good point. And I think what it made me think of as well is that for some individuals who perhaps lack low self-esteem and don't feel able to articulate what they truly want and to communicate their own needs, in some ways the eating disorder is a way to be like, well, it's not me, it's, you know, eating disorder. And in some ways that is a way of trying to kind of shift the responsibility onto something else in some way, because it's so hard to identify what they want, and it feels easier in some ways to displace it onto the eating disorder, if that makes sense.
It totally does. I think I've had experience that myself of like, one, if I've wanted something that feels wrong or kind of I'm ashamed or embarrassed about wanting it, it's like you just say that the eating disorder wants it, because then it's putting that onus on somebody else. But equally, you know, I had behaviours that were really not very nice to be around when I was struggling, and you know, I became quite a horrible person and stuff. And whether or not that was me, who knows? But I would often say, "I'm really sorry." Like, yeah, that was the eating sort of took over, or like, you know, the eating sort of was just getting at me, and I acted in that way. And it gives you almost an excuse to act in a way that you never would normally do, and you don't want to just say, you know, "I'm really sorry that I acted like a dick there."
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think just off the back of that, I think for some individuals, so some of the participants perhaps who had that really chronic low self-esteem and didn't feel like they were loved and didn't feel like they were getting into the relationship they wanted to get into, in some ways it felt easier to kind of attribute that to their eating disorder and being like, well, it's because I've struggled with my eating, rather than kind of that's felt easier than rather than saying, you know, what the alternative in their mind is kind of maybe it's something to do with me. And so in some ways it kind of was a way to be like quite fearful of overcoming their eating disorder in case they still felt this sense of loneliness and not being loved by others, and if they did, what would that actually mean? And there was a real question mark.
Yeah, it's that whole like not really knowing who you are And therefore, if you've got the eating disorder, you can kind of, any bad behaviours, you can say, oh, that's the eating disorder. But it's that, again, that vulnerability of, if I don't have the eating disorder, all that's left will be me. And what if that is awful?
Yes, yes, exactly. And I guess kind of it's related to that, but kind of slightly off. But I it's made me think of that within the context of a romantic relationship, some of the participants described almost, in some ways, it was help. They in their minds, they perceived their eating disorder as being helpful in the relationship because it meant that they were distracted from focusing on other difficulties that may have arisen in the relationship. So they were focused on the eating disorder or the anorexia as a couple. And actually, that meant that they weren't having to think about, you know, other struggles that they might have to encounter as a couple, or in their relationships. And so it's a sense that, you know, this eating disorder is important. It's a necessity. It's mm-hmm. needed both for my sake and for the sake of our relationship.
Yeah, almost like whatever issues we're having in our relationship, well, the eating disorder's at the forefront, so we don't need to discuss them, or we can just blame mm-hmm. them on the eating disorder. You know, it's not actually a sort of issue with our relationship itself.
Yes, yes, exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there is, of course, even within the same participant, within the same individual who feel that, there's that conflict that we spoke about, that kind of ambivalence where at the same time they hate the eating disorder and don't want it as well. So they're kind of holding these conflicting feelings, which, of course, understandably leads to frustration. And I think I can definitely relate to what you said, Hannah, is kind of not feeling like a very nice person at times when you're really struggling. But, you know, hearing my participants' accounts and their experience really gave me a sense of, actually, it's really hard, and it's really hard for so many people with this, and they're battling with so many of their own thoughts, and you know, it became so apparent to me through my research.
Yeah, and I think it's so straining on a relationship as well, because I don't know whether your participants kind of discussed this, but I often found that I'd be sat there with my partner trying to have a conversation or something, but my eating disorder would be so in my head, I just couldn't connect. And then it just meant that our relation, like our connection stuff, was driven so far apart, because this eating disorder was constantly telling me, you know, you need to do this, or you're not good enough at that, and that then pushed us apart. And I think one area that really affected my relationship, and you kind of mentioned it as a theme before, was our, you know, relationship with sex, for so many elements, in terms of, you know, not having a sex drive, not wanting to be naked in front of somebody, not being able to form that connection, sort of the anxiety. Like, I don't think this is a topic that's often spoken about, but, you know, when you have an eating disorder, you think you're crap at everything. So one of those things is sex. You know, you're not pleasing your partner, you're not doing this enough, you're not what have you. But what was the experience of the participants in terms of that?
Yeah, no, that's, you know, it's such a good point. And I think, you know, it's, as you say, it's not really spoken about much. Or if it is, I think, from my experience of hearing people speak about it, it's often, there's sometimes shame in talking about it, and it's really important. It's a really key component to many individuals' experiences. But participants did describe this kind of self-consciousness, as you say, because of their bodies. But at the same time, whilst they felt self-conscious about their bodies, they felt this need to please their partner and to want to meet their needs. So some of the participants described engaging in sex without any enjoyment at all, and actually with a lot of anxiety because of how they felt about their body, just in an attempt to kind of keep their partner happy and to make sure that they didn't leave. And there was kind of, in a couple of the accounts, actually, kind of what came across is that within, kind of whilst having sex, there was this kind of constant conflict, in that they wanted to be attractive. They wanted, because they were aware that their partners their partner's desires were to have someone who, I'm kind of thinking quite specifically about some of the participants' accounts, but some of their partners would want them to be quite curvy, and so they wanted to look like that, but at the same time they didn't because of the eating disorder, so they couldn't win. It was almost kind of, they were constantly being pulled in multiple directions, but they were not pleasing anyone. And ultimately they were engaging in these activities that was making no one happy, because what they reflected on afterwards is that even their partners were not, you know, weren't satisfied by the encounters because they weren't fully present. You know, the person that they were in a relationship with was also in a very strong relationship with their eating disorder.
I mean, I think you have just summed up how an eating disorder impacts somebody full stop, in terms of the eating disorder has this promise that if you engage with it and do what it says, everything will be better. But actually, by engaging in the eating disorder, you separate yourself so much from your loved ones, from yourself, from everybody around you. And as no matter how hard you try, you are never going to be good enough for the eating disorder. So, you know, you can do all that it says, which goes against everything, you know, that the people around you sort of not like want from you and stuff, but, you know, just being connected to people, the eating disorder tells you to do stuff. So then you're disconnected from people. But what you're doing for the eating disorder is never going to be good enough. So then you end up in this awful situation where you're not connected to the people around you, you're not good enough for the eating disorder, and you just kind of left feeling even shitter than you started. And then the eating disorder behaviors get stronger, because it's like, okay, yeah, well, I know I said this, but actually I meant this, so you need to try harder, you're not trying hard enough. And then that separates you even more.
Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately you're just getting further and further, you know, moving further and further away from the outside world, and more at the mercy in many ways to the eating disorder. And I think, you know, you become more vulnerable to the grips of the eating disorder as well, because of the physical effects of starvation. And, you know, your mind is less able to think rationally. And so you are, you know, you are kind of, there's a sense of being trapped for many of the participants that they describe, being just unable to break free sometimes because of the power it has over them. And it seemed for many of the participants that not even their partners were able to drag them out of it, and actually ultimately the relationship did have to end in some cases.
Yeah, and I think you hear about that a lot, and I think it's completely devastating, because, you know, ultimately if you're in a relationship with somebody that you love and want to be with, you know, it's horrible to think that an eating disorder can be so powerful to separate you. But I think something really important to highlight here is, like, a lot of the time people will kind of, you know, look down on people or think, you know, how could you possibly let go of your relationship for your eating disorder? And I think we need to kind of change the narrative on that. It's not like, how could you let that happen? It's think about how incredibly strong and the hold that that eating disorder has over somebody, that they are, that they are kind of more likely to follow the eating disorder than they are to, you know, break free, recover from the eating disorder and be with their partner. Because I know for me, when I was at the depth of my eating disorder, I very nearly broke up with my partner quite a few times. And I remember thinking and beating myself up of like, how can you do this? Like, you're letting this eating disorder win. But actually it wasn't that, it was that I'd become so vulnerable and weak to the eating disorder, and it had so much power over me that I felt like I had no choice. It felt like the only option.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just goes back to feeling really just at the mercy of the eating disorder, where in some ways you don't feel like you're in the driver's seat. And I think also, just going back to what you said in that, I think, you know, as you mentioned, some people can sometimes, there's this people often say, you know, how could you, you know, let the eating disorder win, and how can you lose so many relationships? When actually we also need to take a step back and realize that individuals are all part of a system, and actually the sometimes it's the dynamics, kind of they're both feeding into each other. So so partners or family members may relate in ways to the individual that in a way that not intentionally in any way, but in some ways it's part of the dynamics where it's not just the individual with the eating disorder that has chosen that route. It's, you know, the dynamics that have emerged because of the very, very complex situation. So it's an individual in a very complex system, and they are not in isolation, you know. And I think the reason I say that is because one of the themes that came up on the topic of boundaries is that some of the participants described how their partners often in their attempts to help and support them, actually in some ways it kind of led to this, not in all participants, but I'm just thinking of a couple of examples, led to this kind of codependency where the partner in some ways felt like they were being very nurturing of their partner by looking after them and making sure that they ate, and the individual with the eating disorder didn't kind of was responding to that, and there's this dynamic that kind of took hold, and in some ways it wasn't a kind of a very complex interplay and reciprocal dynamic that was going on, where it wasn't just the individual that was with the eating disorder that was kind of maintaining the disorder, if that makes sense. And that's not in all cases, and in the majority of cases what's clear is that it seems to come from a place of love, you know. And it's so difficult to know how best to respond to individuals with an eating disorder. I think even the individual themselves don't always know, and it's and you know, sometimes there isn't a right answer. A lot of the time there isn't a right answer, and it's so individual but I think what I'm trying to emphasize is the fact that it's not the individual with the eating disorder that's solely to blame for allowing the eating disorder to take such a hold. There are so many different factors and elements involved in a very complex system.
Yeah, I think it's really it's a really good point that you bring up about codependency. And I did an episode, God, it must have been like 2 years ago now, with a lady called Veronica, and she had experienced codependency herself in that her daughter had an eating disorder, and it made recovery really difficult for her daughter, because Veronica was then sort of like had latched onto their relationship in the sense of, I can now care for you because you're ill. And then it meant that, you know, she was quite reluctant to letting go of supporting her or looking after her. And I guess that is the same thing here with relationships, is, you know, you could start to develop and build your relationship around the fact that one person looks after the other, and the other person could get more from the relationship because they're needed. And so as somebody then develops and recovers from their eating disorder, they develop this sense of identity and this like independence that could then be really difficult for the other person to be like, well, you've needed me and now you don't need me. And it's not this fact that they don't need them anymore. They just need them in different ways. And I think that's so interesting, and it must be really difficult for somebody in a relationship with somebody that is going through recovery, because that individual will go to therapy, you know, or go for support, and they'll be able to talk about it. Whereas the individual that is supporting their loved one, there's often very little support, and they are just expected to all of a sudden sort of, you know, be around this person that's very different. And I know from anecdotally, again, like for me, I will now maybe I'll go out for lunch with my mum and I'll just order something and eat it. And she's just like, I just need to kind of be okay with the fact that you're okay. Like, obviously I want you to be okay, but like adjusting to the fact that that wasn't an ordeal and I was just able to do it and I didn't need her to support me in choosing and things like that. And that must be so common in relationships as well, is that you really have to shift. You don't want to trigger somebody by bringing up a past behaviour, but equally that's been your normality for so long.
Absolutely. And I think you've just explained that so, so well, much better than I could have ever imagined doing that. But yeah, you've absolutely captured the complexity of it all. And it highlights the fact that, you know, relationships are so complicated and it can be really, really challenging. And I think what the research shows as well is that for individuals with anorexia, and I think some other subtypes, is that there can be sometimes difficulties with individuation and separation. And so, you know, there can often be an enmeshment in relationships. And so it is even harder to sometimes to let go of the eating disorder when you feel that you've been able to create in what feels like a very strong bond. And it's not that they're not able to create that bond without the eating disorder, but in their mind, that's what it is. You know, the eating disorder is what's kept them together. Yeah.
Yeah. I distinctly remember one of my exes. I met him when I was really unwell and I had to break up with him because I just, in my back of my mind, it was like, he loves me for the low weight that I'm at. And it wasn't any fault of his, but because we had met when I was a particular, you know, had a particular physique at a particular weight, I just thought, if I gain weight, you know, our relationship means nothing. So it's, there's just so much complexity to it.
So much complexity. And I guess it also speaks to, as well, all of this complexity also goes back to just how the complex relationship people have towards their eating disorder in general, where, you know, often a strong part of individuals want to get well and want to recover and want to be able to eat what they want to eat and what other people are eating, but another part of them doesn't want to, you know, in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases they really don't want to, because in their mind the eating disorder has benefits, and part of those benefits are sometimes kind of exacerbated, I guess, by how other people are responding to them. So it's kind of like, well, you know, this is actually giving me this. This is giving me this. It means that my partner is making sure that he's here with me at lunchtime, and he wouldn't be. He'd be at work otherwise, or, you know, things like that. So it just speaks to the complexity of not only relationships, but also eating disorders. And then when the two are interacting with each other, there are so many different factors involved that really need thinking about. And I think that's why, you know, when thinking about supporting individuals with eating disorders, allowing the sufferer to express their experiences from their perspective. And I think that's why I was so passionate about doing qualitative research, which gives voice to the individuals themselves, rather than thinking, oh, it's this, you know, some quantitative research. And this isn't to say that quantitative research isn't really, really great and helpful in many ways, but, you know, focusing only on quantitative research can mean that we are not hearing the nuanced complexities and not doing it justice for each individual, how complex it really can be, the experience.
Yeah. And I think you highlight the importance. I think it's something that people are talking about a lot at the moment in terms of like acknowledging lived experience, and rather than just like the statistics that research gives out, you know, actually speaking to people. Okay, well, the evidence base suggests this, but how did you find it? And really getting that. And obviously that will be unique to everybody, which I think is why it makes it difficult, because everyone's experience is so different.
Yes.
I'm sure there's a lot of common themes that come up from people's lived experience that then can be translated into support as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think because a lot of researchers, understandably, they want to have results that perhaps that they can generalize, and, you know, that is going to be applicable. But actually what we need to recognize is that eating disorders are so specific and individual. Yes, there can be themes. Yes, there can be similarities. But in order to really understand or increase our understanding of eating disorders, we really need to understand the idiosyncratic experiences of individuals so that we can build a picture, a more realistic picture of what's going on for so many different people. And then we can hold these in mind when when we are supporting different people. You know, it's not that these factors are determining factors. They are just things that we need to consider. And I really think that, you know, that's why I'm really passionate about just giving a voice to each individual. And that's so important. And I think particularly for Black women who historically in research have not been given a voice, have been marginalized. And so there's an extra layer there that I felt really passionate about, and which drove my research.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important to kind of, you know, really focus on the experiences of everybody rather than the experiences of people we focused on in the past. And I just wanted to, I guess, finish us up because I can't actually believe how long we've been chatting for. It's,
oh,
I could speak
gosh.
To you for so long. You mentioned the kind of last theme was hopes and dreams for the future. And I'd really like for you to bring the experiences and the thoughts that you got from your participants, but also your hopes and dreams for the future in terms of the research you've done and how you'd like to see that going forward.
Yeah, so I think what really came across for the participants is that despite so many of their challenges and their difficulties, both in terms of their eating disorder and their relationships, many participants had this strong sense of hope that things could get better. They felt really positive about their the prospect of their romantic relationships and about recovery. And what multiple participants described actually is that often relationships are idolized in the media and in society, and what they found helpful is kind of reconceptualizing and redefining romantic relationships and realizing that once they do that, they are able to, you know, the prospect of achieving a positive romantic relationship feels really possible. And they're able to hold on to hope. And I what was really kind of what I've been reflecting on is that what I took from that is what I would really hope for is that a strength-based approach is often adopted by practitioners, and realizing that actually individuals who have often been seen as perhaps weak or vulnerable in many ways, they're actually, we are able to capitalize on the fact that actually in spite of their difficulties, they can hold on to hope and there is resilience. But at the same time, I'm also mindful of the fact that particularly with Black women, I don't want to kind of reinforce the stereotype that Black women have to be strong and resilient and, you know, they don't have eating disorders and they have to keep going. So it's about striking that balance. And I think one of the key things that I hope for is what this research shows is that every individual is different and it's such a complex system. What we need to recognize is that there are so many different dynamics at play. There are, we really need to recognize the intersectionality between different factors and different individuals when trying to understand them and to give them a voice. I also really hope that this research might be kind of a starting point for further research, because I very much recognize that, you know, as my research is focused on women and it's also focused on cisgender women, but I also very much recognize the importance of expanding that so that we can include those that are perhaps more diverse in terms of their gender and their sexuality, males. There are so many different avenues that this research could go down, and I'm just really passionate about hope, like trying to kind of instill passion in others to be able to do this. And I guess my hopes as well, I think hearing participants' accounts, I really hope to be able to do kind of give them a voice and do what they've kind of do them justice, because what they shared was so empowering, so encouraging, and so inspiring. And of course, I've obviously had to kind of select some of the accounts that they've given and not been able to incorporate so many different aspects of it. And I really hope that I can do it justice and really highlight kind of in a non-defensive way that what I am saying and my interpretations are just my interpretations and are not the participants' entire lives and may not actually be their truth. You know, it's just one interpretation. So I guess if I'm coming away from this, what I really hope is that people are able to realize the importance of giving a voice to individuals themselves with eating disorders and recognizing the complexities involved in, you know, the kind of intersectionality between race and culture and eating disorders in the context of romantic relationships. And then realizing that even with this knowledge, there is still so much more that all of us can learn and need to learn and need to be willing to be curious so that we can really continue to grow in our understanding and our in our knowledge.
Yeah, Well, I think you are absolutely doing it justice. And, you know, your passion really does shine through the way that you talk. So I have every hope that, you know, you are just the kind of start of this research, and long may it continue. Because I think, like you say, it's such an important topic, and does really need, you know, more research into it and more people sharing their experience because it is so diverse.
Yeah,
so thank you so much, Lauren. It's honestly been such a pleasure to chat to you. It's been so lovely, and I only wish that we had many more hours.
Yes.
Where can people go to find out more about you and any research that you're doing?
Oh, so that's a really great question, because I'm in the process actually of setting up a kind of different social media channels.
Amazing.
So at the moment I haven't actually got them all set up, but what I'm gonna do, Han, if it's okay with you, is once I do, I will let you know,
absolutely.
And then hopefully you can pass that on.
Sure.
But I'm, now that I've finished my research, because I hope to kind of create new platforms now to be able to kind of spread what my research shows, and I'll definitely kind of hope I'll give that to you, and hope for you to feed that on, if that's okay. Thank you so
much. Absolutely.
I've really enjoyed kind of speaking to you, and just kind of, what's really refreshing is kind of hearing your insights as well, both, you know, kind of personal insights, but also kind of clearly your experience from hearing so many different people, you know, and it's just really great. And I think just personally as well, having had experience with anorexia, it's really validating as well, I think, talking about it, talking about these experiences and talking and kind of recognizing that, you know, even though in the kind of the depths of your eating disorder you can feel very alone, actually these experiences sadly are shared by far too many people.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? Sometimes when I, you know, talk to someone and they've got some experience, I'm like, oh god, that's really shit, like I wish that you didn't have to feel that. But equally, I think by us sharing our experience, you know, hopefully somebody listening is like, oh, actually I'm not alone in this, and it is okay, and actually they got support for that, so that's okay for me to reach out for support. And like you said, it's a real validation, and I don't think that it would ever be sort of like a it's okay and you know it's okay to deal with this. It's actually not okay, and there is support out there for you.
Absolutely.
And you are totally deserving of that support as well.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
Thank you so much for having me, Han. I've really enjoyed it.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.